Welcome to episode 227 of Troubadours and Rock On Tours, with yours truly, E.W. Conundrum Demure. On this week's program, we have New York City artist and activist Alberto Villalobos to talk with us about his musical journey from Mexico through Europe and now to New York City. Mr. Villalobos is a very accomplished violinist. Also, his artistic endeavors regarding making masks, in particular in sculpture, and an installment of 43 masks, more specifically, that is now being displayed at the Point Gallery in the South Bronx. These 43 masks commemorate the disappearance of 43 college students a couple of years back in the Iotzinapa rural community just outside of Mexico City while they were on their way to protest. It's a great conversation. We talk about humanity. We talk a little bit about that incident and what inspired him, what it means to him. We talk about family, and we talk about brotherhood and sisterhood. We talk about feeling like the other. We discuss politics and corruption in Mexico, here in the United States, our own president, and what's going on in Washington, D.C. We get into a lot of different areas. It's a great conversation with Alberto Villalobos. We also have another well-crafted and beautifully read essay by Dr. Michael Pavese, a.k.a. Uncle Cesare, our associate producer and resident essayist, for you today in the program. We also have an EW essay by yours truly titled Ourselves and a poem titled The Sin. And as is always the case, we have also to share with you several great tunes. Hola, thank you for being here. Let's get to it. Episode 227 of Troubadours and Rock On Tours.
When do I get to see you again? When do I get to see you again? I wait. I wait.
Ourselves. The stank on this dank narrative of a so-called presidency has the possibility of showing us who we are as a citizenry, as individuals too. There are different sorts of treachery in the physical world, in our metaphysical as well. But we consider, as do most of our human contemporaries, indoctrinated with a Western worldview, yes, we consider ourselves of the first world, a top-tier functioning nation. But we might be witnessing the end of all that. We've become sluggish, heavy-handed, narrow-minded, arrogant, and lazy. Our sense and depth of moral, ethical, salt-of-the-earth, high-minded endeavors, and enlightened existence, intellectual, instinctual, spiritual, has been diminished, is skewered, has been lost and devoured by baser, much, much baser tendencies of our human existence. What shall we do? Is what I am saying true? Who am I? Who are we? Who are they? Who are you?
Si tú ya tienes un coro, si tú ya tienes un coro, ¿quién soy yo para cantarte?
caeré sobre tu frente, y un caeré sobre tu frente, y una flor sobre tu oreja.
Hello, is this Alberto?
Alberto Villalobos is speaking. Hi.
Hi, how are you? This is Lawrence, a.k.a. W. Conundrum from Troubadours and Rock on Tours. It's nice to have you on the program, sir.
Thank you, Lawrence. My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Before we get started, let me give the folks listening a little background, and then I have several questions for you. First, Alberto Villalobos, and I have to say right now, I am a typical American who only knows English well, so I'm going to apologize for mispronunciation up front, but you are a visual artist, a violinist, and composer living in New York City. You graduated from the University of Veracruz, where you studied under Mexican pedagogue Carlos Marrufo. You hold a master's from the Royal Conservatory of Music in Brussels, Belgium, where you studied with Igor Ostrak, and Alberto also studied with Liviu Prunaru at the International Yehudi Menuhin Academy in Switzerland, and with Zachar Braun in Vienna. Along with your two brothers, you're a founding member of the award-winning musical group Villalobos Brothers. And with three violins and original compositions, your music carries messages of love, brotherhood, and social justice. Together, you perform regularly around the world and have graced the stages of Carnegie Hall, the Latin Grammys, the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and the 60th anniversary gala concert at the United Nations. And today we're going to talk a bit more about your, most ambitious project, as you call it, the handcrafted collection of 43 clay masks that honor the memory of the disappeared students from Ayotzinapa, Guerrero, Mexico. And right now they're on display at the Point Campus Gallery in the Bronx right through the end of this month. Very, very impressive bio, and I commend you also for the focus of your latest artistic endeavor regarding the mask. So let's welcome to the program, and let's get started with this, if you don't mind, Alberto.
Thank you, Lawrence. That was a bio that you read for me. Thank you so much.
Yeah, you don't realize sometimes how impressive you are until someone else tells you.
You made me actually revisit all my school days with the Maestro Carlos in Mexico. And by the way, I sent a big, big hug for all our family and dear friends in Mexico that eventually will probably be able to listen to this interview. We have, basically all of our family in Mexico. As you mentioned, we are three brothers living in New York City for 12 years. And we did leave behind a lot of family and dear friends, and of course teachers, who foster our musical, our love for music, and our sense of unity as a family, if you will.
Wonderful, wonderful, and that trek from Mexico to New York City. Can you give us a little insight how that occurred? I mean, you're a university student and in Mexico and then in Europe. How did you end up in New York City as an artist?
Oh, absolutely, Lawrence. I consider myself very fortunate, very fortunate to be part of a family that really encouraged art and especially music as a discipline, right off the bat. I mean, my mother and my grandmother And even I remember listening to a lot of music growing up, and my mom eventually, she was a Montessori self-taught educator, and she opened up a preschool just for us, and we were mostly homeschool because she didn't trust the system, the public education system in Mexico. So we were pretty much homeschool, and when she found Maestro Carlos, who is a recognized teacher and violinist in Mexico, she found a musical figure, a musical father for all of us, and eventually he became our mentor and our teacher for many years, until we found the means through scholarships and through competitions to continue our education in different parts of the world. In my case, was through a scholarship of the national government, of the Mexican national government, and I was fortunate to spend 3 years studying, as you pointed out, in Europe at the conservatory there, which was quite an experience. I have to say, it was hard to be out of the security of home at 19 and having to do everything by myself. But looking back, I think it was the most valuable experience that a young musician and a young person can have, to be out there by yourself and studying abroad and really expanding your vision and your horizons, not only in music but really in life.
And music we're talking about mainly, and obviously you're an accomplished musician. You right now, though, also have a focus on your other artistic endeavors, namely your handcrafting of masks.
Right. Yeah, I remember ever since living in Mexico, I was really inclined to painting and creating visual art, especially sculpture. I've been doing that for a long time as part of my I don't want to call it a hobby because it feels more like just part of my everyday activities. With my brothers, I remember we started using some of my creations during concerts. My older brother, his name is Ernesto, and he suggested, he said, Alberto, why don't we incorporate some of your creations for this piece that I wrote? You know, and then that's how everything started. Really, I had been doing masks, and I had been doing experimenting in different mediums and techniques. But I would say around 2006, we started doing music and adding theatrical elements, such as the masks and the projections of my paintings during the shows, and that brought a whole other layer of interest in my case adding that also that platform to create and to inspire through visual arts. So it's been a long journey for my visual arts as well, together with the music, but I think essentially they come from the same source, which is creativity. You have to nourish that creativity through your own life and experiences, but also let it come alive in any forms that you consider necessary. In my case, it's through visual arts. For many other people, it could be through dance, poetry, music. So it's just a way of expressing and to reflecting the world that we are living nowadays.
Well said. Well said. And you're,
thank you.
When you're making your masks, is it the techniques that you employ, are they traditional techniques that you've learned from people in your family, from people in your community, or are these formal techniques you've learned at art school?
Right. I remember growing up and studying music in Mexico, I would sneak out of my classes some days, and I would just the school was designed in such a way that the visual arts school was next door to the music school, and I was just fascinated by the process of sketching and seeing my friends at the art school, creating all sorts of you know, printmaking, sculpture, clay. So I've been attracted to that scene all my life. But when you get to a place like New York City and you get exposed to so many different things, and not only music, we've been fortunate to collaborate with amazing musicians, talented people. But also, you know, you visit museums, you talk to people. I visit a lot of workshops, and I eventually, my girlfriend Megan took me to a pottery studio because she started pottery a few years ago. And I felt just an instant connection with the clay and with the soil, with the earth in my hands, that I was it felt so natural that I just got stuck to clay. And that's why I decided to make this collection of masks out of clay, or using clay as my medium.
And that brings us to the exhibit in the Bronx right now, called Hombres de Arcilla, I think.
Hombres de Arcilla, that's right, Lawrence.
Men of clay. Right.
Men of clay, that's
and
correct.
Tell us the story. I mean, I know the story. It's a troubling story. Tell us a little bit, for those who don't know, what's behind this effort and your feelings on it.
Absolutely. Well, Hombres de Arcilla, Men of Clay, it's a project I've been working on for over 2 years now, and it incorporates elements of an art installation. In this case, the masks are mounted and presented as an art installation, and also music. And I created a composition called also Men of Clay that it's right now being mastered and, well, mixed and mastered in Mexico. And how I envision this project is coming together as a whole art installation, combining the clay masks, the music, and also a strong element of activism, because the masks honor the memory of 43 missing students from Ayotzinapa, Guerrero, which is a small town in the south. Southern state of Guerrero in Mexico. These 43 students went missing 31 months ago in 2014, as they were heading to Mexico City for a big protest against the sad events happened in 1968. So they were heading to a protest, and as doing so, they were intercepted by police forces and kidnapped and disappeared. So these are really truly horrendous and sad events, and I think it's our duty, our job as artists, as citizens, to speak up and to reflect and to find ways to, and I think ultimately it's the power of art to transform, right? To transform these events and to find beauty, and also in this, an inspiration in these sad events.
Yeah, and what you're doing here reminds me of the Chinese artist Ai Weiwei. He does things of this nature to commemorate and to remember some of the travesties of against humanity in China, and it is powerful, and it gets the story out to people now, and it touches them in a way that maybe a news article won't.
Exactly. I think when words and when the even music, when music and words that just don't suffice, visual art come to the rescue and show us and makes us feel and reflect in a different way. So I think this is the value of this exhibit. You know, spreading the word and letting people know about these facts. Maybe people who have never heard of Ayotzinapa or the 43 missing students are, for the first time, are listening to this subject right now. And this is probably the biggest success of the exhibit so far. I've talked to people that have visited the gallery and said, like, this is great, thank you for doing this, and to me, that's already a big success.
And this is at the Point campus?
Gallery? That's right. This is right now being exhibit at the Point. The address is 1391 Lafayette Avenue in the South Bronx. When I first pitched this project to Yolanda Rodriguez, the director of Bronx Arts Factory, a nonprofit organization in the South Bronx, she put me in contact with Carrie Clark, and she's the director of The Point. And you know, they were both very supportive. They were engaged and really committed to revitalize the South Bronx and especially Hunts Point area, where The Point is located. And I visited the space, and I really loved the sense of a community garden, and that they created there. So I thought it was a perfect spot. Hunts Point, as you probably know, it's been going on. It's been a struggling neighborhood for many decades, and right now it's under all this gentrification movement. The neighbors are really doing an amazing job organizing and creating strategies to stick together and to not being forced to move. So that's pretty much the story of how this mask got to the South Bronx. I am a Bronx resident. I'm on the west side. I think it's important also to collaborate with this kind of organizations that have a history of working with the community.
Yeah, well, that's the activist in you. You're an artist, you're an activist, and those two worlds meld together beautifully, I think, and you're doing a great job of that. I commend you. And I want to ask a further question about the masks themselves, the 43 masks that recognize and honor the 43 students that have disappeared. There are many stories about what might have happened. They may have been given by the local police to drug gang members, lords, and they perhaps assassinated them and then got rid of their body somehow. That's what I've read. And the government supposedly has various stories about what they think happened or what they want people to think happened. And, you know, not unlike most governments, there's corruption involved. And I'm wondering two things. First of all, the masks themselves, are they modeled after the actual features of these 43 students, or are they just random human expressions of people? Did you model them?
That's an excellent question. I tried both approaches, Lawrence. To be honest, it was very tough to model the masks individually as portraits. To me, at least, I thought they would encompass a larger meaning if they represented feelings. For instance, it comes to mind a couple of titles of my masks. As opposed to name them with the exact names of the disappeared students, which, by the way, were really young. The age range is probably younger than 25. They were really young students. I named one, for instance, Freedom, or Peace, or Fear, or even I have a double piece that is called Corruption or Impunity. So I think my approach was more figurative, if you will, but at the same time, our feelings that we all empathize with. I created one mask in particular. It's probably one of the pieces that I feel more proud of, because it's an installation piece in which it's called The Scream, El Grito, and the purpose of that piece in particular is a suspended mask that is screaming and is suspended by wires to two wooden posts covered with nails. And the mask is placed in front of a mirror on an easel, and the visitor to the gallery can place himself behind the mask and see his reflection on the mirror.
That's powerful.
So I think through these kind of installations, we can really find or make visitors empathize with the suffering, not only of the young students that were kidnapped, but also of the families that are left behind. We were fortunate enough to have one of the parents, Jorge Tizapa, attending the opening exhibit and sharing his thoughts. I had never met Jorge other than through text, through the cell phone, but it was really an honor to see his reaction and to see what he had to say about the exhibit and how determined he is to find them alive. Because, you know, it's very important to mention that for all the parents out there still not getting any conclusive evidence, the students are still alive. And they're not going to take anything else until they receive evidence of the contrary. And the government, on the other hand, is giving us the same speech that they're giving everybody. You know, they're saying the students were involved with drug gangs, they were burned, their bodies were burned, even though the international teams have determined that there is no evidence to say to conclude that the bodies were burned. So I think through clay and the significance of clay and fire, you know, how clay gets stronger with fire, and other pieces, like, for instance, the Six Hombres piece that is in the middle of the gallery, in which six masks are covering ashes. I want to convey the meaning of hope, and I want to convey the meaning of finding them alive, because this is what their parents are willing to do, and they're really willing to go the distance and to not rest until they find them.
And let me ask you, what did these 43 young students do that was so threatening to the?
Well, they belong to the movement called the Escuelas Rurales, the rural schools, and truly there is nothing threatening about it. If anything, it's a very commendable effort of rural towns that gather around agriculture. Really, the rural schools are centered around being self-sufficient and not depending on the larger cities, and they have a history of being really well-organized communities. And so, if anything, the government was probably scared of more rural schools coming, taking more force and organizing and really speaking up for their rights. As I mentioned, they were heading to Mexico City to protest exactly for a massacre that happened in 1968 under President Díaz Ordaz. And this is a well-documented event that happened in Tlatelolco. You know, everybody knows about this in Mexico, and there was going to be every year, actually, on October the 2nd, there is a protest at the same plaza that where you can still see on the buildings the gunshots, and there is people who live through that and suffer through that, and I can, you know, testify. So these students were actually going to protest when they were kidnapped.
And let me ask you this too: are you getting any attention from your government about this installation, this artistic endeavor in honor of the 43? Are you getting any pushback from them?
Not really. I mean, I haven't really seek the spotlight with this exhibit. I think it's our duty. You know, it's not the first song or the first artistic activity that linked to activism that we as brothers or as a musical group start or complete. My brother Luis is also heavily influenced by you know, political activism in his songs, and we try to really make music, and in my case, visual arts, a way to communicate and to connect with people, but also to share real facts, you know, to share real struggles and to give voices to people who sometimes wouldn't have necessarily the opportunity to speak up. In particular, it comes to mind one song that he wrote, Luis, about police brutality, for instance, which is not only a problem of Mexico, but truly is an universal the problem around the world. And you know, through tackling these difficult issues and making people pay attention, I think it's our way to say, hey, you know, art is also a powerful tool for change.
And when you look at the, we'll shift gears a little bit, we're talking about the homeland, I guess, where you were born, in Mexico, and the corruption there and the problems there. What about now being here in North America, in the United States? Well, Mexico's part of North America, in the United States, and seeing, witnessing the present executive branch, you know, the Trump administration. Does that concern you?
Oh, absolutely. You know, as artists, I think it affects us directly, and we are all concerned, not only as artists, but as Mexican citizens. And right now, we are all really outraged and in awe. You know, we're like, we don't have words to describe how our reality has changed in a matter of months. And I want to share a short story that happened to us not so long ago. We have, in 12 years that I've been living in New York City, I've never felt discriminated or under no circumstances. Really, we've been really blessed. But after President Trump took office, I, as a Mexican citizen, I have felt changes, you know, and you can say that they're not evident for everybody, but I do feel them. You know, I feel them. We were touring upstate New York City, and we stopped by a gas station. This is just a short story to kind of tell you about more what happened there. But we were just walking into a gas stop, really a gas station, and so people were actually saying, talking about the wall and how they're Trump is going to build a wall and Mexico is going to pay for it, and then they suddenly turned their backs and they said, okay, well, these guys look Mexican. I was talking to my manager, Juan Canagi, and they turned, they saw us, and they suddenly stopped talking. And we just went ahead and ordered our coffee and got out. And I asked Juan, hey, Juan, do you feel that? Do you feel that? How they? And suddenly we were both agreeing and saying, like, yeah, that was really weird. That I never felt that, you know, how suddenly you become, you know, like an observer of a situation that you don't really want to be part of.
Yeah, you're sucked into this role as the other.
Exactly. So alienated, if you will.
Yeah.
So I think it is alarming, you know, the unprecedented level of negligence and ignorance of a man in charge of this country. I think it should be a sign for everybody to wake up and to really start acting through any means possible, really, not only art, but we have all our fields of expertise where we can really create change to whatever it is that we do.
And, you know, you're one who does not believe, I gather, in division so much. You believe in brotherhood. You believe in humanity through all of its, and with all of its differences, embraced, working together, living together.
Oh, absolutely. I think that's the core of our message. You know, in every presentation, every concert, every workshop that we do a lot of outreach activities, not only with immigrants, with communities, but also with schools. With I remember we went to Vermont. We talked to we do a, what is it, like the third year that we go to a farmer's market out there. It's called the Feast and Field Market in Barnard. And it's a wonderful community of farmers, of organic farmers. And so places like this that are doing their part in impacting the community in a good way, I think we're always going to be delighted to collaborate with. And as you said, the message that we want to convey is that of brotherhood, is that it's possible to create a change through art and positive energy through music, and to really create change through the activities that we do.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're talking with Alberto Villalobos, and he is an artist and activist. Presently, he has an installment at the South Bronx Gallery, The Point, and it commemorates the 43 disappeared students from Mexico, a rural community just outside of Mexico City. He's also in a great musical ensemble with his brothers, very accomplished violinist in his own right. Alberto, it's wonderful having you on Troubadours and Rock On Tours. Do you have any contact information you'd like to share with folks so they can learn more about what you're doing?
Oh, absolutely, Loris. My personal page as visual artist is albertovillalobos.com. And the page that we have with my brothers is villalobosbrothers.com. So you guys can find a lot of information there about what we do, about concert dates, about future touring dates with Villalobos Brothers. And also I try to keep it updated for my visual arts project and everything related to my visual art there.
And your last name is spelled V-I-L-L-A-L-O-B-O-S.
Correct. Villalobos. It literally means wolves is lobos.
Right.
So village of the wolves.
I love that. I knew. I noticed that translation. Like one of my favorite bands is Los Lobos.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
I learned it back then. We have just a minute or so. I'd like to give you an opportunity to make a closing, share a closing insight or thought for our listeners.
Absolutely. Stay alert. Guys, I think it's very important times that we're living right now, and we do have the power to change our reality. I would say stay creative, stay loving, and believe in your family, because for me it's been essential to work with my two brothers. For some people it's hard to believe, but it is possible to work with your brothers and make music. And stay hopeful. Stay hopeful, because otherwise, you know, it's impossible to create a better future, a better reality, a better world. So that would be my message. Find us if you would like to ask or to get in touch or to share our problems or not only your problems, but your activities as an individual, as an activist, or as a musician. We'll be delighted to meet you. And and I'm looking forward to meeting you all.
Same here. Thank you, Alberto. And hopefully we cross paths up in the South Bronx. I'd like to see your installment. But nonetheless, wonderful talking with you, sir. Keep up the good work. My compliments.
Appreciate it, Lawrence. Have a great day.
You too. Ciao.
Bye now.
la atmósfera azul.
Mayor, do you have a drag? The old elevator operator asked. This was back when there were old elevator operators. I was in City Hall, and I was applying for a summer job. And the old man wanted to know if I had a connection. Someone on the inside who would pull my application from the pile and give me the job. You have to know someone, the old man said wisely. He knew. We all knew. Our depressed former coal town was notorious for its nepotism. Municipal jobs were handed out to brothers, sisters, cousins, friends of friends, nephews, nieces, and neighbors. And the recipients clung to their jobs until they died, or until a new administration brought in its friends. Some of the jobs were no-shows. We heard tales of phantom employees of, say, the school district, who cashed payroll checks for years, but never encountered a student, a secretary, a janitor, or anyone else from the school district. As it happened, I did have a drag. My mother was a distant cousin of the mother of the man who was doling out the jobs as head of the Department of Public Works, our future mayor. Mayor McGinty was one of our city's most colorful and memorable public servants. My mother wasn't one to be pushy. In fact, she hated pushiness and often complained about pushy relatives and acquaintances. But in this case, she called upon my Aunt Teresa, who was close to the future mayor's mother, to put in a word. The word worked. I joined what could only be called a motley crew who roamed the neighborhoods to clean abandoned lots, dusty parks, run-down baseball fields, and other neglected areas around town. Drew, a louche fellow with shaggy bleached blonde hair and a daily hangover, was our group leader. He spent most of his time telling us of his exploits of the night before. Tequila sunrises, frisky girls, fights or near fights, and driving to other sites to hobnob with fellow, equally hungover supervisors. Dave, who sported a blonde mullet, was our sophisticate. The son of a funeral director, he claimed to be well-traveled. He once related a story of a dirty French girl, in both senses of the word, and an unwitting, lusty traveler that smacked a little too much of a standard farmer's daughter's story. Eric, the oddball, was a disgruntled conspiracy theorist with a cool VW bug. Together, we successfully avoided work with short days, long lunches, and cleanups that dragged on much longer than they should have. Once, a little too enthusiastic in attacking overgrown shrubbery, I wandered off beyond our appointed lot and caught poison ivy. I was mildly reprimanded for my ambition and sent home for the day. "I'll tell them you have it everywhere." My leader winked and then headed off to nap in his car. All of us were indebted to our future mayor for our cushy summer jobs. But he is not only a benign boss tweed, divvying out employment to friends and family. He was also something of a Medici to our town. He spearheaded the use of the showmobile, a traveling stage that toured the neighborhoods with all kinds of shows. Big band concerts, dance recitals, musicals and plays, including Fiddler on the Roof, and Turandot, and the Three Riddles. Mayor McGinty was a showman himself, perhaps more so than a politician. As a politician, he was a Roosevelt Kennedy Democrat, a populist with his own New Deal. As a showman, he loved big gestures and big parties, and he was a big man, portly, with a red face and a shock of curly, orangish hair. This florid figure picked the red rose as his trademark, and he handed out thousands in his day. The old ladies flocked to him, as did my mother, who loved him as much as she loved Roosevelt and Kennedy. And he basked in the attention while making that personal connection that is gold for a politician. He bestowed hugs and kisses along with the roses. He was elected mayor, but only lasted one term, the showmanship apparently not translating well into day-to-day governance. His bold, optimistic plans, restoring a beautiful old train station and bringing a tourist attraction to town, came fully to fruition only after he left City Hall. He ran for office a few more times, and then he became a campaign consultant, a radio and TV talk show host, a commentator on local, state, and national politics, a fondly remembered character from our town's past. I knew him through my job as copy boy at a local paper. Reporters liked him as much as the old ladies because he liked them and because he always had a good story. He'd roll into the newsroom, chat everyone up, from young correspondent to grizzled managing editor, exit laughing with his entourage, and move on to other small stages in our city. When he died not too long ago, mourners waited for hours to pay their respects. There were roses everywhere.
That's life.
That's life.
That's what all the people say. You're riding high in April, shot down in May. But I know I'm gonna change that tune. When I'm back on top in June. I said that's life.
That's life.
And as funny as it may seem, some people get their kicks stomping on a dream. But I don't let it get me down. 'Cause this fine old world, it keeps spinning around. I've been a puppet, a pauper, a pirate, a poet, a pawn and a king. I've been up and down and over and out. And I know one thing, each time I find myself flat on my face, I pick myself up and get back in the race. That's life.
That's life.
I tell you, I can't deny it. I thought of quitting, baby, but my heart just ain't gonna buy it. And if I didn't think it was worth one single try, I'd jump right on a big bird and then I'd fly. I've been a puppet, a pauper, a pirate, a poet, a pawn and a king. I've been up and down and over and out. And I know one thing, each time I find myself laying flat on my face, I just pick myself up and get back in the race. That's life.
That's life.
That's life. And I can't deny it. Many times I thought of cutting out, but my heart won't buy it. But if there's nothing shaking come this here July, I'm gonna roll myself up in a big ball and die. My.
The Sin. And the beautiful rays of warm, orange, yellow, clear sunlight bask over and through us, the rainbow colors of what is within. To not see and embrace this beauty is what you religious folk might, should, for sure call a mortal sin.
Just made it didn't call. I'm fancy first.
And there you have it, episode 227 of Troubadours and Raconteurs, with yours truly, E.W. Conundrum Demure. I'd like to thank those folks who made this episode possible. First and foremost, our new friend, the wonderful artist and activist, Alberto Villalobos. Thank you so much for the wonderful music, the beautiful masks, and the activism. It's so important. Also, I'd like to thank our resident essayist and associate producer, Dr. Michael Pavese, a.k.a. Uncle Cesare, for his wonderful work. And how about a round of applause for these musical artists? The Pretenders, the Villalobos Brothers, Lin-Manuel Miranda, Van Morrison, Brentford Marsalis, and Terrence Blanchard, too. Thank you so much for listening. Until next week, enjoy this week.